housekeeping message before we ask you to introduce yourselves, and then we'll listen to your briefing. Most of you, barring the Honorable Shobhis Tuna, I think, would have received telephone calls from the advocate, Madame Fella. It's not my intention to discuss that issue now, but we will need to reschedule our meeting with her. When she spoke to me eventually, when I decided I'm in a good enough mood to speak to her or listen to her on Sunday, I put it to her that it's not appropriate for me to listen to her. I would prefer her to speak to the committee. I don't see myself as a go-between between anyone and the committee. The committee belongs to its members, and so it's appropriate that she speaks to one of you in a properly convened meeting and explain what happened, and you are entitled to then respond in the manner that you deem fit. So that's as far as that's concerned. So we will be rescheduling another meeting. Mr. Jeffries is abroad with the Deputy President, so excuse me, we won't see him this week. Then is the DA, the Honourable Dean Smith, and Schaefer are running late. I expect them to catch up with us during the course of our meeting. What's the other Mr. Fulani wants to know if our meeting is going on for the whole day or is it just this morning? Ah, yes. Mr. J.B. Simonioni, as you know, is now a member of the Judicial Services Commission, so when that commission sits, he has a standing apology with the committee. So we place ourselves in your very capable hands.
Honorable chairperson and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to do this briefing to the committee today. My name is Lawrence von Thielen. I'm the business executive, amongst others, responsible for the justice portfolio. To my right is Trudy Botha. He's the senior manager that was directly involved in the audit of the Department of Justice. She will be doing the presentation and I will be assisting her. As we discussed before the meeting, we will, during the session, we will first of all just focus on a bit more on the content of an audit report and why do we include certain things in an audit report. It will hopefully help the members in assisting you in interpreting an audit report. And then we will go to the audit report of the Department of Justice, and we will also discuss with you a summary of the audit outcomes of all the other entities in the portfolio. I must apologize, when you referred now to the public protector, I realized that we didn't include the public protector's outcomes in here. I forgot that this committee's also got oversight over the public protector, but what I can't, we will amend that slide and we will forward it to you, but what I can tell you is that it was an unqualified audit report. I can just not remember the detail on whether there were any other matters that were reported and to what extent, but we will just update that slide and give it to you. I would then like to hand over to Trudy. You're welcome to stop at any time throughout the presentation, and obviously at the end of the presentation we're also available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you,
Chair.
Honourable members, as Lawrence indicated, I will first take some background in terms of the audit report and then thereafter deal with the audit outcomes of the Department of Justice and then the NPA together, and then lastly a very high summary of the other entities. I'm going to start on slide 4 with this legislative requirement. First of all, it's required that in terms of the people like the accounting officer is responsible for record keeping, also then to prepare financial statements for auditing and then submit that to the Auditor General. And then our responsibility is that we need to audit and then thereafter report to the accounting officer. Then secondly, in terms of the constitution, it's also a responsibility that we need to report and on all the financial statements and the financial management of all government institutions. And then lastly, the Public Audit Act governs us that we need to expect opinion or a conclusion on the financial statement and the financial position, compliance and financial management, and then lastly on the predetermined objectives. When I go to the audit report structure later on, you will see that all these three aspects have been covered in the audit report. I apologize, we have currently four different types of audit opinions. Obviously, the one with the green face is where we are working towards. Basically, that would mean an unqualified opinion with no intricate matters, no non-compliances with laws and regulations, no findings on predetermined objectives. The four different audit opinions, first of all, unqualified, or we call it also unmodified, qualified, disclaimer, and adverse. The last two are the two audit types of audit opinions that we don't want in government. Obviously, they're qualified as well, and we strive to have an unqualified opinion for all. On the next slide, I'll be explaining the different types of audit opinions when we rate them. First, unqualified. Basically, if we come to a conclusion that the financial statements are a true and fair representation of the current situation, or that it's fairly presented in all material respects in accordance with the applicable financial reporting framework. Then the second audit opinion that we have is also unmodified, but with the emphasis of matter. So your audit opinion are not affected. We just write an additional paragraph that is useful for the readers, for them to understand the financial statements. And then thirdly, a qualified audit opinion is basically when we conclude that we cannot express an unqualified opinion that's not fairly stated in all material respects, and that's due to normally a disagreement with management, as they might have departed from a financial reporting framework, or a limitation of scope. However, it's not so pervasive and material that we want to express a disclaimed audit opinion or an adverse audit opinion. There are two audit opinions that you don't want to have. The first one is a disclaimer. Basically, a disclaimer means when there's a significant pervasive limitation of scope. So basically what we say is there was not sufficient appropriate information for us to be able to conclude or to have an audit opinion. And then an adverse, we write an adverse opinion as where there's a disagreement with management and it's material and pervasive that we cannot just express a qualified audit opinion. We need to, in the end, have that as an adverse opinion. The next item I will basically deal with the audit report. I'm not sure if everyone has glossies of the annual report for the Department of Justice and then for the NPA. Basically, if you want to take go through it with me from page 115 for Justice and page 62 for NPA. And I'm going to first high level touch on how the layout of the audit report is structured. First of all, it deals with the report on the financial statements, then report on legal requirements, then internal controls, and then lastly, other reports. Underneath the financial statements, we have the introduction paragraph, then the responsibilities of both the county officer and the auditor general, then the opinion, which I referred to my previous slide, and then an emphasis of matter paragraph, if any, and then also additional matter paragraph, if there was something that we wanted to highlight. And then under the legal requirements that link back to the Public Audit Act, where we are expected of us to have a conclusion on your predetermined objective as well as your compliance. So we have an item where we report on that. And then also we highlight the internal control weaknesses, and we have three headings that we classify as the weaknesses, first in terms of leadership, then in terms of financial performance management, And then lastly, in terms of your governance environment. Governance meaning your audit committee, your risk assessment, your fraud evaluation, and then your audit committee. And then lastly, we have other reports. If there were some investigations happening, also if there was a performance audit or an agreed upon procedure. For both the Departments of Justice and for NCIS, there was not agreed upon procedures nor performance audit. So we will only then refer to the investigations that were conducted. I'm going to just explain high level what is the emphasis of matter and also additional matter. It's very important that those two items do not have an effect on your audit opinion. So you can still have an unqualified audit opinion with emphasis of matters. There's two items that we want to highlight. Emphasis of matter or additional matter. The only difference between the two, emphasis of matter is where we want to draw the user's attention to something that's actually in your financial statement, that is useful for them to understand the financial statement, where other matters is something in the annual report, so excluding the financial statement, that you want to highlight to the user. So that's basically the two differences. One, emphasis of matter, something in the financial statement, additional matter, something outside the financial statement. Then on the next slide, there's currently 8 types of emphasis of matter paragraphs that we raise. First of all, if there was in terms of financial reporting framework for a department, it's a modified cash basis of accounting, so we just emphasize that. If there was significant uncertainty with, for example, a legal claim or a matter that's not certain as yet, so we just want to raise that to management to the user attention. If the previously issued financial statements have been revised, if your corresponding figures have been restated, if there's a material underspending of the budget, and then accruals, I will explain it a little bit later because the Department of Justice has that, what the accrual means. That's basically a possible overspending of your budget, which could constitute an unauthorized expenditure. And then second, lastly, if there was a problem, a going concern problem, or financial sustainability. And then lastly, we just want to emphasize if there was irregular expenditure and through different ways of expenditure. So here we just emphasize, so it might be that we are happy that it's fairly presented, so you don't have the qualifications that things are irregular fruitless. We just want to draw management attention or the user's attention that there was some irregular and fruitless expenditure. And then lastly, additional matters. We have 3 types of additional matters that we do report in our audit report. If it was audited in the past by another auditor, if there was material inconsistencies, then we review the annual report in terms of what is presented in the financial statement. And then lastly, if there's schedules in the annual report which we have not audited. So those are the 3 additional matters that we highlight. For the Department of Justice, I'm going to give you a history of the audit outcome for the last 4 years. For the Department of Justice, they have been qualified with other matters. So other matters is either a combination of predetermined objectives, compliance, and internal control. So actually their audit outcomes have not changed since the last 4 years. However, there was some improvement in terms of the number of qualifications, but they are still qualified. And I will touch on later in terms of what are the reasons for those qualifications. And then for the National Prosecuting Authority, they were qualified before 2019, and last year was the first time that they received an unqualified audit report. However, it's still very important, there were still some other matters, so they are not clean in all materials and in all aspects. So it's very important just to know that we are still not at that point where we can say yes, everything is 100% with the National Prosecuting Authority. On my last slide, I will take you through the other entities in the portfolio, but I think I'm going to first just focus on the Department of Justice and the National Prosecuting Authority. The Department of Justice was qualified due to 2 reasons. The first was that all the accounts linked to third-party funds, so that will relate back to the departmental revenue, and receivables for departmental revenue, contingent liabilities and provisions relating to third-party funds, and then secondly, the completeness of the irregular expenditure, and then NCA, as I previously indicated, had an unqualified audit opinion. Page 115. the matters that we've highlighted, as I previously said, you have the incident matter and the other matters, incident matters, financial statements, other matters, something in your annual report. We have emphasized after the Department of Justice there was some corresponding figure that has been restated. We want to emphasize that there was some irregular expenditure disclosed, the same with fruitless expenditure, and then accruals. And then under other matters, that there was unreal schedules which we have not audited. And then for the NPA, only two, also restatement of corresponding figures, and only irregular expenditure, and then the type of other matters, there were schedules which we have not audited. Okay, so I'm going to first hide. Yes.
She did when, in the beginning, telling us about what an unhoist, I mean, what a qualified opinion, unqualified opinion. So, if she could also tell us about the statement of correspondence, the statement of
basically, what we mean with three statements of correspondence, we're taking either be through our audit, we identified, because obviously we audit every year, each and every account balance, so there might be something that we audit which might relate to the previous year. Then we go and investigate, so it might be either that we've identified through our audit for this year that there was something that the department missed, so we pick it up and they go and change the prior year figure, or when they prepare their financial statements or they just say, reviewing all the financial statements, they realize something look off, they investigate, and then they realize there was either an item which was not fairly presented. So then they go back and restate. What they are required to do is then underneath each and every note where there was a corresponding figure that changed, they have to put in the details why it is so, and so it's disclosed in the financial statement. Just before I continue, I'm just quickly just overview of the audit outcomes, and then I'll go into the Department of Justice with the detail explaining each and every item that we have. Then in terms of the predetermined objective, there was no findings for the National Prosecuting Authority. They had a clean, there was no findings that we reported. But then for justice, we have two items, the usefulness and the reliability of the information, but I will touch later on with the details. Then we report on compliances. There was both findings on non-compliances for both the Department of Justice and the NPA. And the non-compliances was in terms of the PMA, Public Service Act and Regulations, National Treasury Regulations and Practices, and then the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act and some of its regulations. Then in terms of internal controls, we have summarized concerns in terms of the internal control environment only under the two headings. Previously, you will remember there was three. In terms of governance, we did not identify something that is material that we have to emphasize in the audit report. So our concerns were more in terms of leadership and then in terms of your financial and performance management. From now going forward, I'm going to touch more now on the details of the actual qualifications, the evidence of matters, and then also the other requirements that we need to disclose. The Department of Justice has been qualified due to all transactions relating to third-party funds, and the reason for that, I don't think it's a new, it's a standing matter. The inaccurate financial system, the lack of proper policies and procedures and internal controls resulted that we could not confirm that the revenue collected by the fund have been properly recorded and surrendered to the Department of Justice, and then also that the potential claim against third-party funds regarding theft, losses, and fraud to be paid by the Department are complete due to the inadequate financial control system, and then lastly, the money that the third-party funds have collected but not yet surrendered to the Department are also completely recorded by third-party funds. Then in terms of irregular expenditure, the concern that we have there was not a proper system in place by justice to identify and report. Most of the irregular expenditure we have identified throughout the audit process that in the end arrived where we said, due to the absence of a proper system, we cannot conclude that all irregular expenditure has been identified and reported. So we qualify them on the completeness aspect of irregular expenditure.
the question for you to clarify was the concept unaudited material. What causes that? Lack of time to audit the stuff? Or why do you have unaudited material?
Unaudited schedules.
Yes.
In the financial statements, we have that there's, I think it's in terms of the inventory, but we've decided not to audit that because there was a practice note out that the department is still in the process to develop the requirements for inventory. So in the end, then we decide that we will not audit them because they're still in the process to rectify matters. Or there might be other initiatives that just supporting the financial statements, but there's maybe more detail. And then we say, well, we don't audit that. So it's not due to timing, it's more a decision that we made that we will not audit specific annexes. But in terms of financial statements, we audit the whole financial statements. It's just supplementary annexes that might give some more detail in terms of the financial statements.
If I can just add to that, there's currently a process to move from modified cash basis to full draft. So if you take, for instance, inventory, and draft is generally recognized accounting practice. Yeah. So it's close to GAAP, generally accepted accounting practice. It's just a bit adapted specifically for public sector. So all the public entities are already on the GRAP standard. The department on modified cash basis, and that's why we also got that emphasis of matter on the modified cash basis. So they're in between. There's a lot of disclosures already in the financial statements, which are very close to what we call accrual accounting. Accrual accounting basically means you don't account just when you've actually paid, that you account when you've incurred the expenditure. Now, there's a lot of additional disclosures that goes in hand with that. If you, for instance, take a national department currently on the modified cash basis, they now at the point where they disclose their assets in an asset note cost. There's not yet any depreciation. GRAP will require that there will be depreciation and those things coming in future. Now, if you look at inventory, for the 11-12 financial year, most probably inventory can move up to the point that we have to audit it. National Treasury must still make a final decision on that. The reason why it's a process is that if inventory, for instance, must be audited and entities are not yet ready to properly account for it, it will lead to a lot of qualification. So entities need to get the opportunity to get the systems in place to properly account for it. Department of Justice may be not so challenging, although if you just think about it, 500 odd magistrate officers, you know, if each of them has to account for whatever inventory they have, you need very good control. If you go to other departments like public works, imagine the inventory that they carry and that they need to be account for. So it's a process. It's coming. The day will come that you will express your opinion on that. But for now, it's at least disclosing it so that one get an idea and that system can be put in place. Then there's other disclosures in the annexures which Treasury actually requires for their usage. And we've agreed with Treasury that not all of that will necessarily be audited throughout the audit process. That's why it's very important that we indicate in our audit report pages, we've audited pages so and so. Those additional information has not been audited, so that the user must be very sure where to cut off what is audited and what is not being audited. But it's a very, very valid question.
That's touched with the qualified audit opinion. The next item I will go to the emphasis of matters that was raised for the Department of Justice, just again to highlight that it's only disclosed. It won't affect your audit opinion. So basically there was three restatement of corresponding figures. I think we've explained that there was some figures that was changed due to error identified by the Auditor General or by management themselves, and they have adequately disclosed it in the financial statement. Then there was some irregular expenditure that incurred in contravention with the Confidential Procurement Policy Framework Act, some of the supply chain management policies and procedures, finance leases outside the transversal state extended board contract. So that's for the 2011 extension mainly that we've identified. And lastly, accruals. Accruals basically mean that there's payments that they have disclosed that exceeded 30 days. Had the Department of Justice stayed that in time, it would have resulted that they overspent in terms of their budget, which could have constituted in unauthorized expenditure. So we just highlight that there's a possible indication that had Justice paid all the invoices on time, they might have incurred unauthorized expenditure. Separately disclosed. So basically, we just highlighted that there was some problems. Obviously, remember, for the Department of Justice, we did have a qualification as well because of the completeness. We have identified some that they have not identified. Therefore, doubting the system that they have to identify and report on irregular expenditure.
I just want to know if there is a possibility of the administration delaying a little bit to pay the part so as to avoid a qualified what do we do in the future to make sure that there is no such loophole?
What I would like to know is when expenditure occurs in contravention of the Act, are you able to identify the person responsible for that? And what are the consequences? Anything that happens to the person responsible has been broken the law?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, members. Indeed, very good question. The first one with regard to the emphasis of matter with possible over expenditure. That's indeed why we raise the emphasis of matter. There's a requirement of the Treasury regulations that all accounts, invoices, creditors must be paid within 30 days after receipt of the invoice. Obviously, bearing in mind that you're happy that the service has been rendered, that the goods has been delivered. And the reason for that regulation is twofold. First of all, to make sure that the entities get paid in time so that there's not an interest charge. Also for small entities to make sure that they don't run into cash flow problems. But then also to prevent a situation where you delay payments unduly to stay within your budget. So that's why we emphasize it, and that's why when we do the analysis, and if you look at in the financial statements, you see that the entity must analyze, really can quickly look for that note, and I can point you to that note. In that note on accruals, you actually need to disclose 30 days and more than 30 days and whatever. So we focus on the over 30 days, because in terms of relations, you're allowed 30 days, and we say, when it goes over 30 days, there's a possibility that you might have delayed payment to stay within your budget. So we don't say they have, we say there's a possibility, and that's why we do the calculation to say, if we then take all the old ones over 30 days, we deduct it from your surplus, and you then move into a deficit, there was a risk that you slow down your payment to stay within your budget, and not to incur irregular expenditure, unauthorized expenditure. The tool is note 20, is note 22, and you will see there, that's on page 163, you will see there that the more than 30 days is 217 million. Quite a significant number. With regard to the irregular expenditure, the PSLA is very clear. The PSLA has got four requirements. The first requirement is that you must prevent irregular expenditure. The second one is you must have processes in place to detect irregular expenditure. The third requirement is that when you've identified irregular expenditure, you need to disclose it in your annual financial statement. That's why we qualify if we believe you don't have proper systems in place to identify all your irregular expenditure. The fourth requirement is that you need to investigate each case. You need to determine if someone can be held responsible, and if someone was can be held responsible, that individual needs to be held responsible. So it's very important as part of the oversight function of this committee that in your oversight meetings you follow up to determine what action has been taken. Very good question.
Yes. So in this particular case, there's such investigation being done, and no one comes to be liable.
In fact, if you we'll take you to the disclosure note on irregular on irregular expenditure that the department let me get to the detail here. The department has reported to say cases are in different stages of investigations and no disciplinary steps have been taken yet. Guilty parties are expected to respond to the department. So that's the progress that the department has reported on these cases. So it's very important for this committee to do the follow-up. How far are these investigations? How many individuals have been held responsible? How much money has been recovered? So that is the current status of these cases. I know for a fact that the department at some point in time appointed someone to assist with all these investigations to try and determine was it negligence, was it just an oversight, can someone be held responsible, you know, but this is the current focus.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've indicated that for all this past how many years? The department, FOIA department has qualified the opinion. Now, in light of the question I asked and your response, that they are investigating and so on, has anyone been found to be liable for any kind of pension that provided for either in the procurement political market or the European Union? No, it's supposed to be coming, we're supposed to be following up all that, but we are checking on it. They should know.
I don't have the details with me. I suggest that's a question that you should rather maybe pose to the department. What we do is during the audit process, if we find that the department is not investigating, we will then report to say that they don't do the investigation. But if you even look at that, where we report on other investigations on page 119 of the audit report, we reported that the investigations were still ongoing. So, but remember, there's many cases. So you and we won't report on each and every case in the audit report. So the department can give you the details to say, look, we've investigated 50 cases, two people found guilty, two just reprimanded. You know, they can give you the full details of that. You won't necessarily find those details in the audit report. But I think you can also request the department to maybe be a bit more detailed in the way that they report it in their annual report to make it easy from an oversight perspective to follow without any further processes where what the progress is on that.
Okay, thank you. And just on to follow up with the previous question on page 118 of your report, you mentioned the procurement and contract management. That question now. If this continues every year, obviously, do you, as in auditing, do you ask the department then, and we need to follow up as a part of our oversight, but I see here there are a number of procurement problems here. Awards are made to suppliers on the preference point. Straightforward things like awards are made to suppliers who fail to provide proof that they're up to date with the revenue service. Now, that's very serious. That means they owe tax and they've been paid state money. This next one, the contracts were modified to circumvent fair supply management, 36. Then 37, employees perform remunerated work outside the employment. So these are issues we need written explanations from the department on these as well, but maybe we should have engaged more our own folks, you know, to what degree did we engage when we had the department. But we need to follow up this. The one issue that I did raise with them was revenue management 39. The trust office did not take effective to collect money due to department. Now, there's millions of rand due to department, but they're not collected, and we've got a briefing on that. So there seems to be quite, and the point that I want to make is it's very useful, this report to assist us in our oversight. But what happens if it comes up every year, the same thing? Do you then take further action besides just lifting or dropping the audit when it then becomes qualified or disclaimed almost, because these issues are not being dealt with and repeat year after year after year? What steps can you take from your side? Do you take?
Let me just explain the process. I think we can, at this point in time, the audit report is the ultimate way of communicating the final outcome. So what we do to try and influence a better audit outcome is that we now for a year and a half are doing what we call quarterly key control assessment at the department, where we go in, we assess the key controls, and we, amongst other, focus on supply chain management and all the areas that we are now a traditionally high risk area. We will then engage with the CFO and the DG on those key controls. We also have engagements with your minister on those key controls, and I must say that your minister takes those engagements very seriously, and normally after our key control engagement, you know, there's serious engagement between him and the accounting officer and the senior officials and in the department. And then I've also had a discussion earlier on with the chairperson of this committee on the key control, and we would actually like to engage on a more regular basis on the key control so that you also have an in-year feeling of what is happening with those key controls. What is also very important is that one should never forget the role and importance of internal audit, and that is what the AG does from outside. But internal audit primarily role is there to test the key controls and to report on the key controls, so that appropriate action can be taken literally on a day-to-day basis to make sure that the key controls are functioning. And the honourable member raised a very valid point in terms of basic issues such as engaging in procurement with an entity that doesn't have a tax year certificate. It shouldn't happen. You know, so there should be basic checks and balances in place. There should be proper training. Now, I just explained earlier on that it might be a challenge in the department due to the number of points where procurement takes place. But therefore, you need to have a very, very strong system in place for supply chain management, proper training of all the individuals involved in supply chain management, proper performance management. There should be a link between audit outcomes and performance management. You know, that individuals in areas where there were negative audit findings should in some way be reflected on the performance of those individuals. So a culture of compliance should ultimately be created.
Before I recognize you, I'm not sure if Mr. Tolley will understand this, because this is what we used to do in the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence. And it's a mission on my part, which we must ensure doesn't happen again this year. This engagement we're having now with the Audit General's Office was had right at the beginning of the process, so that they alert us of these key points. What we've done this year is we've had the Director General and her top staff, and we've engaged with them to the best of our ability. And now we're having this exercise, which is a bit the wrong way around. Yeah. So next year we must do it the other way. Okay. I just felt that I needed to make that point.
when we do engage with the department, we are armed, and not only that, we have the Audit General's office present in that particular meeting where we engage with the Director General and the senior staff. But I just thought I'd make that point. Followed by Mrs. Schwab.
That was going on in my mind that we should have different kind of people in the department because we rely on the department. This is what we want to discuss. And then this is what we did. So. But I still wanted to know because I'm carrying over context. But it can be that the auditor general merely examines the book and establishes that certain things have been done before. And then it ends there. I would imagine that you have to follow it up so that when you audit the book in the following year, you are able to tell whether or not the irregularities that occurred or the writing of what have now been defined. That's why I was taught that you should say there are a certain number of people who were dismissed or who were fined, sanctioned in one way or another, or who were brought to court. I think that kind of information would be useful for to know that indeed something is being done, especially about corruption, which as you indicated, tends to be associated with the situation in the
the point of the member is taken. We currently don't report in that format. Like I said, what we will do is, if there's no action being taken, you will definitely see an item in the audit report which will say it's a requirement of the Public Finance Management Act that appropriate action being taken. So where we feel that there's not a process in place and not enough is being done, we will report it in the audit report. In this case, we felt that the investigations are undergoing, and in fact, we did. At some point in time, we did feel that some of these investigations maybe did not go as far as we believe it should go, and that we have reported to management, and we have discussed it with the minister as well. But I take the member's point. What we also do is that from our audit, and we actually now have requested it in the writing also, there's two important things which the entity must do. First of all, they must prepare an audit action plan. What are they going to do to prevent any negative audit outcomes in the future again? And we also have a look at that plan to see whether it will really address the issues, and then we monitor it throughout the audit process and throughout the year to see if management is actually implementing that plan successfully. And that is why our engagement with this committee will also help a lot, because we can then give you a feel throughout the year whether we believe that action plan is indeed effective or not. Secondly, what we do is we actually require now from the accounting officers to give also formal commitment in terms of what commitment they undertake to ensure a better audit outcome. And then we will also track those commitments, and we can also in our engagement give you feedback on our view whether we believe that those commitments are actually successfully executed.
I'm just trying to know, the department for the last 4 years has received qualified audits. Tell me, in practical terms, how long does it normally take suppose if you implement all the recommendations in the report, will a department receive an unqualified audit within a year's time, or how long does it normally take for a department to receive an unqualified audit if it had previously received a qualified one?
Honourable Chairperson, members, it depends on the issue at hand. Some issues can be fixed very quickly. If we look at the two issues at hand at the department, the first one actually deals with the structural issue which relates to the accounting for the third party fund. So that is something where the bigger issue with regard to the third party fund and the accounting therefore and proper bookkeeping and submitting accurate financial statements must first be dealt with before that qualification can be removed. We reported in last year's general report of the Auditor General that the Minister has committed that would be a 2-year process, because if you look at where they are now, it's about 4 or 5 years of financial statements that have not been presented for audit and that must be audited. And that I've indicated earlier on, capacity has now been appointed to assist with that process. But it's also a bigger system issue in that over the long run, a proper system should be developed to account for that fund. So it's a bit of a structural issue, therefore the challenge in dealing with it in one financial year, but certain other qualifications can definitely be dealt with in one financial year. I think the one with irregular expenditure, the challenge of the department is also the multi-location. If it's an environment where you don't have those multi-locations, it can be a bit easier to resolve it. From where we are sitting, we can see this progress in the supply chain management. We can definitely see progress. But unfortunately, it was not to the point where we were satisfied that what has been disclosed in the financial statement is the full picture of all the irregular expenditure. So we can see that there's definitely positive movement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A number of the issues here where you say we can see progress. Now, I've served on the committee 12 and a half years. I think Mr. Landers is longer, 15, 17 years. I don't think the third party has always been a problem. So to say we're going to resolve it in 2 years, I think we've heard that promise so often before. We hope it would be, and we're pleased that there is progress, but it's always been a problem. And that's from 94. But how long does it take to resolve the problem? So that is the one issue that I think that we need to do. That we need your guidance, and I think the usefulness of those quarterly interactions is that it's not been historical, because the AG is always historical. We need to be up to date, and that's where I'm trying to understand the linkage with the various portfolio committees of Parliament. You've got the AGs, you've got the portfolio committee on the AG, you've got SCOPA, Public Accounts Committee. And we've got House of Justice. Then you've got National Treasury that gives out the monthly expenditure. So we could pick up that information on a month-to-month basis, what is Justice spending, together with your quarterly report. So there's all these different avenues of information that's coming. But I think our interaction with you on a quarterly basis is going to be crucial and very useful. And I really commend that. The other issue that you mentioned, the internal audit. Now, one of the reasons why Home Affairs collapsed was the internal audit collapsed. And I was on the Home Affairs portfolio when it reached its absolute bottom, there was no internal audit. Is it not correct to say internal audit is failing here in the department because of the ongoing problems? And yes, we understand it's a massive department, but my concern is if, and that's a gauge, and again, you say we see progress, but are the matters of emphasis not increasing? And is internal audit working? And is that not something we should be watchful of? Because that's your first red light, is your internal audit. And that's something that is very important. Thank you.
Jefferson, indeed, and that's why I earlier on alluded to internal audit. There is an internal audit function in the department, but I think that the capacity should be increased, because it is a huge department. And once again, you need to look at the multi-locations, you know, because that is where your day-to-day control needs to be tested. Now, if you talk about more than 500 locations, you need a very well-capacitated internal audit section just to visit each of those locations in a 3-year cycle, for instance. So, definitely important that there's a very, very strong internal audit focus. With regard to that's focusing on the controls and supply chain management. The structural issues with regards to the third party front, I think, is not necessarily within their hands, although they should test the controls with regard to those monies in trust also on a regular basis. I don't think at this point in time I would like to comment any more about the progress on the third party funds. Maybe the committee can engage with the department on that. I think with that, I don't know.
Thank you, Chair. May I know if there is any corrective training or intensive training for those who habitually produce qualified people, apart from,
Jefferson, that is something which an entity that has received a qualified opinion should definitely consider. And you can also engage with the DG on that. My understanding is, and if I remember, it's in the commitment that we received now from the DG, is that there will be a significant focus on training, specifically with regard to supply chain management requirements. And that's where the helpful engagement will take place throughout the year, if we then can give you feedback on the commitment. And I think you must also ask the DG as a first to share the commitment with the committee. And then we can start to interact with you to deal with on that commitment. And you must also ask the DG to share the OIF action plan with the committee.
Mm.
You know, and then we will come back and we will give you feedback on the progress.
Yeah, sure.
Mm.
Thank you.
Is it possible, or do you have the time and capacity, if the committee would say we would like you to do an intensive audit on the specific area in the department?
Chairperson, we can engage on that because it depends on what it is and what the extent of that is. If it's something, and that's also why it's useful for us to engage with the department, as part of the audit process, we do an extensive risk assessment. So if the committee are aware of specific risks which you are concerned about, you must share it, please, with us, so that we can then take it into account in our audit processes. But we must just be careful about in terms of the expectation gap that you will not necessarily, for something that you bring to our attention, see a special report 2 months later on the table, because we will take it into consideration in the broader context of the audit and a focus in the audit process.
Thank you.
And I think the respect of the Institute of Matters for the Department of Justice. Then there was just 2 items for the NPA, also the statement of the committee, either the court re-identified or NPA identified the error, and then also that there was irregular expenditure that included contravention to the PSLA, future regulations, project management, and the Public Service Act, as well as the National Prosecuting Authority Act. Then in terms of the performance information, there were 2 headings that we reported. First, in terms of the usefulness of the performance information, and secondly, about the reliability. So in terms of the usefulness, we have a concern with what the measurability. We know that 21% of the targets that was reported were not timed out. There is no time indicated when they will achieve a certain outcome. And then 26% of the plan and reported indicators were not clear to ensure that all the data that's collected from all the court are consistent. So that were the 2 concerns that we have in terms of measurability. And then in terms of reliability of information, is that where there was not an achievement in terms of the actual, or in terms of what they have planned, in terms of their targets, we could not always get evidence to support the reasons for why they have not achieved a specific target. Because that needs to be disclosed in their financial statements, and then we audit to see, are we satisfied with the reason that they have given? And we were not in all instances satisfied. And then for certain reported in the objectives, we could not get source information or evidence to be in the end able to conclude that what is disclosed are valid, complete, and accurate. The next item is actually a couple of four or five slides now deals with all the different types of compliance findings that we have and where it links directly. You can see if there's a non-compliance, normally it links, for example, to common status, it links back to a specific item that we have reported. For example, the first two ones, in terms of strategic planning, we have previously indicated there was some concerns in terms of performance information, and this might have been attributable to the two findings that we have, that there's no effective, efficient, transparent system of internal controls regarding your performance information, and then linked to that, that there's no proper quarterly reporting to the executive authority. Had that been done, the issue that we have identified could have been resolved. And then for the APA, it was just a more technical non-compliance that the strategic plan was not approved before they appeared before Parliament. Then the next item in terms of the financial statements, you'll see there's two, it reads similar. The only difference is that we have received a financial statement for justice. There was material findings and edits. However, for justice, they could not correct all of them. For the MPA, there was also a material misstatement. However, the MPA were able to correct it. That's why you say were not and were. So we just want to emphasize that we have received the financial statements. MPA received an unqualified audit opinion, but through the audit process, we have identified certain things that were not correct, so they were not seen from the start. So we just want to raise that as a focus point. The next item deals with your human resource management. As I actually forgot to indicate that we have columns indicating one justice and one for the MPA. The first concern that we have is that not all senior managers sign performance agreements. Secondly, covering both for the Department of Justice and the MPA, that the person in charge of the pay point did not certify on the date of actually when the salary was paid, but that official were entitled to his or her salary. And then thirdly, that we could not obtain evidence that sick leave are not being abused, so there should have been some control by the accounting officer, and we could not get sufficient evidence that they are being monitored to ensure that they don't abuse sick leave. And that only related to the Department of Justice. Then for the Department of for National Prosecuting Authority, the Executive Authority did not determine based on their strategic plan how the organizational structure should be presented and should be rolled out. Also then for the MPA, the cost of living adjustments to the prosecutors were not approved and presented. And then lastly, also dealt with the MPA, that the funded vacant posts were not filled within 12 months after they became vacant. Any questions on the compliance of the human resource management?
The obvious question is why isn't it standard practice that the manager would enter into customer agreements before they are employed to be paid? And why is it? What is the difficulty in satisfying themselves that the people who are paid, the persons in charge of the pay point, that they are, why is it difficult for them to enter this if people are indeed entitled to be paid?
I think we also need to obtain the names and details of the senior managers who have not entered into those performance agreements. That would assist us in our engagement with the department. I don't know whether we get that from you or from the DG, that would be from the DG, in which case then we must do that. Then with regard to add to, I think, the Minister's question, What evidence is required with regard to non-abuse of sick leave? Is it just a doctor's certificate? Is it that kind of evidence? Or is it something else?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, members.
Yeah, I think we would suggest that the committee asks for the details from the accounting officer. It's better that the accounting officer provides it. Once again, I think it's for the accounting officer to explain why there were not performance contracts for everyone. I've explained earlier on, you know, that one should look at performance, total performance management, you know, and therefore in the starting point is performance contracts. And then what is in those contracts? You know, make sure that there's something in those contracts that will drive clean audit. So with regard to the pay point certification, honourable member, I cannot give you any details on why not. Yet it's a very basic control and it's a very key control, because that's the control where you sign off that whoever gets paid this month does indeed work for this department. So it is a very, very important control, and that's why if that control is not in place, you will see it goes to the audit report. It's a very, very basic control, but it's a very key control. So I think, once again, the accounting officer will have to explain on why the control is not executed. With regard to the sick leave, I think we are looking here at more a overall control system to manage sick leave from a perspective of how many days sick leave is taken in my department. What is the cost of the sick leave? Is there potential abuse of sick leave? Are there people that are continuously on extended sick leave for maybe not valid reasons? So it's that total management of the cost of sick leave, because there's a cost factor in sick leave. And you know, if you look at the Department of Justice, it's a labor-intensive department. The bulk of the budget actually goes towards the human resources. So very important to make sure that the sick leave part is managed effectively throughout.
Now, if the doctor has said that person can be off for 1 or 2 days for whatever reason, isn't that a valid reason? And how do you determine whether it was not a valid reason?
It's a bit of a difficult question, that one, honourable member. I think the in government the intention is to manage sick leave, and that's why I said we're talking about overall management. So it will be in terms of strength. If I remember correctly, I think a public servant in the national department can still take up to 2 days sick leave without the doctor's certificate, for instance. So you can get a tendency where an individual continuously take 1 or 2 days without the doctor's letter, and there might not be valid reasons for that. So in terms of managing it, one should at some point in time determine that for this individual, he might have to give a doctor's letter for each day that he's on sick leave. He's managing in those terms. So it's difficult to manage, but you normally find that there will be some things which one can identify and which can be managed.
Mr.
Sanfira
and
Ms. Walker,
there's another issue which is related to sick leave. It's a question of accumulated leave. We came across a case in the Free State of a regional head who had accumulated so much leave that he was now entitled to go on long leave way ahead of his retirement date, and said to the department, I'm entitled to 18 months accumulated leave. I'm scheduled to retire in 12 months. So I want to go and sit at home for now, and you have to pay me. Well, it's created a problem, because they've had to bring in the regional head from Kimberley on a part-time basis. And we said to them, we don't understand how this is possible. Surely you should have some kind of control over this accumulated leave, because use it or lose it, that's one option. The other is to say not more than 6 months back, something along those lines, because now they've said to the person concerned, well, no, you can't, he's got to work. Well, he comes in every day and he sits in his office and does absolutely nothing. Puts his feet up and twiddles his thumbs and plays games on his computer. So to all intents and purposes, he's at work, but he's not really working. But the key issue here is this question of accumulated leave and whether you, as the Auditor General and everyone else concerned, is there some kind of control mechanism for it?
Honourable Chairperson, government did realise a couple of years ago that there's a problem with regard to accumulated leave. So there's a couple of measures that have been put in place to manage it going forward. However, there are individuals in government which, before those measures became effective, did accumulate a lot of leave, which they unfortunately are entitled to. I'll tell you about those measures now. What we do during the audit process is we focus on to make sure, as far as possible, that when leave is taken, that it's recorded, because that is what can impact on that balance in the end of the day. And in certain cases, you can actually be paid out your leave when you retire. So that's why it's important that we do focus on that. The current rules on leave, there are two things that happen, is that firstly, that old leave, and it happens now about time flies, it happens about easily 5-6 years ago, I can't remember them, 2005, yeah. So in 2005, leave was capped. All the old leave was capped, you know, which means you can take that leave, but Tuli must help me out here. I think the capping principle was that leave will be paid out on the salary that your 2005 salary, and it will not be paid out on your current salary. There was a second thing which was instituted, and that is that you must take a certain amount of your certain number of leave days in every year from the leave that you get, and you must take it before a certain time. And if you don't take that leave, that part of the leave is forfeited. So you're only allowed to add a certain number of days to your cumulative leave balance, and a certain number you must take before a certain time, otherwise it's forfeited. So it is being managed now, but it's true. Historically, there was a tendency that some people by the age of 60 would have a year's accumulated.
Yes, sir.
Yes,
in terms of the expenditure management, and that also leads back to the actual audit outcomes of the Department of Justice order match that we've seen from exercise. First one is that the county officer did not take appropriate steps to prevent and detect irregular expenditure, and then also payments that link back to the exercise match in terms of your accrual. Payments due to creditors were not in all instances settled within 30 days after the of the invoice. And then for the NPA, there were two items. The accounting officer doesn't immediately act or report to the relevant treasury if they have discovered irregular and fruitful expenses, because as part of the regulation need to be reported to the National Treasury as well. And then lastly, there was some expenditure that we've identified that incurred without the approval from a delegated official. Then the next item deals with the procurement and contract management, and that's basically linked directly to the qualification that we have in terms of the completeness of the irregular expenditure, indicating that there are some gaps in the current processes that they have in terms of detailed expectations and requirements that the department should follow for each and every transaction or each and every procurement, if services or goods that should happen before the transaction actually takes place. Most of the non-compliances relate to the Department of Justice. There's one or two, and more to the end of my slide, that deals with the NPA. So what we have noted, in terms of procurement between 10,000 and 500,000, three written quotations should be obtained. However, we noted that were not in all instances done. And also, before a tender being, before a tender project starts, is you need to be acted on for a minimum period of 21 days. We know that that's what the law in all instances done. Then awards are made where they have to calculate certain percentages in terms of the preferential procurement points. We know that there was either incorrect calculations or some concerns in terms of the methods that they have applied in terms of that. Then also there was awards made to suppliers that do not have their taxes cleared in order. And before an award is being made, it's supposed to go through the checking process, and if they don't have their tax matters in order, actually be supposed to be excluded from the whole tender process. However, there was instances where it wasn't identified and the tender process followed subsequent to that. And then also that the contract was modified to the extent the competitive bidding process was circumvented contrary to the requirements of a fair supply chain management process. There was only one contract that came to our attention. Then also, very important and a concern to us, it released the form other work that's not approved. So obviously, just as Lotus indicated, all a service organization, that's their mandate. And now the officials are not fully committed and have only that department as a mindset, service delivery can become compromised. And then the suppliers list supposed to be updated quarterly, going through to see if there may be problems with suppliers, if the supplier is not performing, to remove it, if there's new suppliers, that everyone has an equal chance to be having transactions of justice. So we noted that it was not updated at least quarterly. And then lastly, that there were suppliers who received some awards that did not declare if they have any other interest in terms of whether they are employed by the state or any connected to any other person employed by the state. So they need to declare that as part of the tender process. Any questions in terms of procurement?
Yeah. One of the issues when you travel and you visit a small town, and I've never visited a number of small towns, and the issues of a day-to-day urgent need to fix the toilet, for example. How can they get three quotations in a little town where you've got one plumber? Is there room for exemption in such situations where the quote takes to be 10,000-15,000 rand and your area manager wants to sort out quickly because it's an urgent delivery issue? And we've had the toilets, for example. But just the issue of those 500, a lot of them are little towns. You know, so this is Victoria West, I've been to Hanover, which is, I don't think there's one plumber there. So how is that accommodated? Is the exemption process possible? And then secondly, the extent of the remuneration, the outside remuneration of office bearers, of justice officials. It could merely be a person that's lecturing or something like that, but are you able to give us an idea? And we need to follow that up with the department, I think, as well. But what is the extent of that? Could it, if it's running a separate business, then it ties up with the second one of contracts going to friends and family. But have you got an idea as to what is the extent of the outside remuneration? And of course, there's that public service. I mean, I'm sure it still applies. If you do outside remuneration and you don't have permission, that money must be recovered. You have to pay that money back. Is that followed up from your side as
well? Well, in addition, I'd really like to know the names and details of these employees that do remunerated work outside employment in the department without permission. Why can't we get their names and their details? And also, contracts made to suppliers who didn't submit declarations on whether they were employed by the state or connected to any person employed by the state, those names and details as well. I think we were entitled to that. More often than not, this, we look at it, we shake our heads, we say, terrible, terrible, and that's it. Every year, I think we should start putting down, but I guess we'll get those details from the DG. But if you're able to answer, we appreciate it. Especially the question about the little toll.
If
question yet. With regard to supply chain management, the practice note does make provision for circumstances where there's either a sole supplier or where there's an emergency. So in cases like that, the accounting officer or delegated official can approve that they can follow a different supply chain management process. The starting point is to first have the general advertisement and to get a supplier's list, because you first need to then, after you've done that, you will then know that in my area there's only one firm that has actually interested in doing business with the government. So that's your starting point. You see, the challenge is that the constitution and the PFMA require that your procurement should be fair, equitable, and transparent. So you must have some kind of mechanism to show that you've given business equal opportunity to do business with government. But in small towns where there's only one plumber, or even not a plumber, and if the plumber must come from a different town, there are provisions. But what happens is that the accounting officer must, or delegated person, and the accounting officer can delegate it to the regional head or to the head of the magistrate office or whatever, that person can then, if delegated to him, take the decision. But it must be properly documented. It must be documented that you got an emergency, the drain pipe was blocked or started to leak or whatever. We don't have, or I've got one name on my list of prospective suppliers, therefore I need the sole supplier, and then it will be accepted in the other process. What is important is that this is sometimes an area which is a bit grey and misused. So in the audit process, we will try and establish, are we satisfied that it was indeed an emergency? Because there's a difference between, if the example that you cited, I'm happy with, but in some cases, when something which has been in the strategy, we need to have a convention in the year in November, you know, and then beginning of November, there's a approval to urgently appoint a event company, you know, in those cases, it's a bit different, because it was in your strategic plan, it's a question of not proper planning. With regard to the related services, Honourable Member, I see you know the legislation very well. The legislation indeed determines, first of all, that it must be approved by the executive authority, and secondly, that if it wasn't approved by the executive authority, that you should indeed pay the money that you received back into the state revenue fund. So what we've done is we've raised it now with the department. We've done some tests and we said we've identified these cases. So it's first for the department now to follow up whether there was indeed outside remuneration received, and then to take it further from that perspective. You see, the way that we've done our test this year is that we will not necessarily know if it's someone that lectured outside. But that's a bit difficult to determine. So the focus this year was mainly on comparing the payroll information with what is on the CIPRO database. So we would most probably identify someone that is a shareholder in a company or a member of the TCU, and we would then advise this to say that do you have approval from the executive authority to be engaged in business activities.
And thereafter, just to add, that when we have identified there was now a link between the special number and the proper, we go in and ask the department expenditure or the supply, if it was there then procurement work, so that we go two sides. First, was there some work, and basically did the department enter into some transactions with that specific company.
And then you check off the receipt of revenue, you check whether you're paying tax and as well.
In addition to taking the money back.
Thank you. Then the next item we'll deal with the last non-compliance matters. The first one in terms of revenue management, being directed to the qualification in terms of third-party funds. There's not appropriate steps taken to collect all money. money that is due to the department. And then in terms of asset management, we noted that there are some concerns in terms of the control does not prevent that, that the asset price can be misused or some losses offset in terms of assets. And then lastly, that links back to the concern that the facility raises, that we could know in all instances see that where there was alleged financial misconduct or discovery, that investigation was being conducted within 30 days. So it's an item that we have raised to their attention. Then the last item deals with the internal control weaknesses that we have identified, and we summarize this for Department of Justice and MPA under two headings. First of all, leadership, and then secondly, in terms of financial and performance management. And basically, we say that there is not sufficient oversight responsibility in terms of the financial and the performance reporting and compliance with laws and regulations. And then secondly, that the internal policies and procedures pertaining to your performance information were not sufficient. But remember, there was a finding that we had on your source documentation were not all instances available, and that links back to the end that what is reported in the performance information could not in all instances be verified. And that was only for the Department of Justice, because the National Prosecuting Authority did not have findings on their performance information. And then in terms of your financial performance management, that we consider that management did not prepare regular, accurate, complete financial performance reports to support or to ensure reliable information. And then lastly, that your monitoring control is not sufficient to pick up any non-compliance with laws and regulations.
It's almost like a standard sentence in a number of the attorney general's reports that I've seen where they're in the state of the sense that they want to qualify for that. Auditor general. So what, how serious is that state? Is it a very serious indictment? Because if I read that, and we have quoted it to the accountants and so for the state, it seems a very, I'm talking about the sense, all those sentences, the leadership, the number one, bullet number one and number three in particular, they seem to be quite serious indictments. How serious do you see it on a point of 0 to 10? Is it 9 or is it low? When you read it, and then the response that we've got, and I had it yesterday with the Land Bank, or one of these, and they said, no, but that's a standard accounting term. And I said, no, I'm sorry, as a lawyer, that is a very serious indictment. It's not just a standard accounting term. Don't quote me on the Land Bank, I'm not sure which institution it was. But because they say it comes up with standard terms where there's a statement of emphasis or something, that it almost goes according to that statement that he put in. How serious is it?
On the okay, but remember, I will not revert to numbers. But what I will explain it is that it is serious, and if you look at the context on how we word it in the audit report, in the audit report we basically say the following led to the negative findings with regard to either the opinion or performance information or compliance. So it's directly linked to the negative outcome in the audit report. And therefore it's serious, and it's so serious that we actually reported it publicly to say this is the area that we believe that needs attention to prevent the audit outcome. And I can assure you that in our engagement with the DG of Justice, when it comes to this area, it is serious engagement. Because she most definitely takes this kind of reporting very, very seriously. That I can assure you. And in the environment in which I audit, it might be different environments, but mainly in the environment where we audit, the moment that we start and we put anything under the heading leadership, it's normally taken very, very seriously. So it's serious because it's directly linked to the negative overcome. And yes, understand it, but I don't think that makes it less serious. Because if it's something which leadership needs to address, then it's something that leadership needs to address. It doesn't make it less serious because it's a standard, it's a standard wording.
I just want to know if you found that there is a person responsible for filing both the things. Because for me, it's very crucial that the department make available both the things. So if there any person who wants to find that responsibility, and if not, are they going to make sure that we don't find the people who we need to have both documents in order to apply our mind.
Thank you, Linda. The answer actually leads back, first of all, that in especially in terms of performance information, that we had a finding that the performance indicators are not clear to ensure consistent recording of information. So especially in a decentralized environment, if there's not clear guidance to say, I want to have this specific document to, in the end, conclude on performance reporting. So in the absence of clear guidance, no one knew exactly what to submit. And in the end, when we request those information, they themselves then realize that what needs to be presented are inconsistent, or they might not have specific services. Directly linked back that they don't have a clear quality procedure framework for performance reporting that in the end will ensure that what is collected is in the end complete, valid and accurate. So there are some entry points in terms of getting the documentation, but it's not clear exactly what is expected in terms of full documentation. And then the last match in terms of the audit report, as we have to report that there was some other reports for both the Department of Justice and the NPA. Oh, I apologize. There was investigations. At the Department of Justice, it was conducted by independent party on request to the department to identify if there was procurement irregularities and also then to identify possible fruitless expenditure. But the investigation was still ongoing at the time that we concluded on our report. Then for the NPA, there was also an investigation. However, it had been finalized when we concluded on our report, and there was recommendations that certain officials need to be, action need to be taken against certain officials.
Where the investigation is ongoing, and this one where the investigation is finalized in the NPA, and that the Auditor General's office has recommended that action be taken against certain officials. That we definitely have to follow up on.
Otherwise, if we are waiting, or it has been indicated what kind of action has recommended?
Oh, yes. Did you recommend specific action? No,
you
didn't.
Okay, listen, no, we can't recommend the specific action. If you look at the PFMA, there's a section in the PFMA which determines that whenever there's an investigation done and someone has been found guilty, that needs to be dealt in accordance with the relevant disciplinary policy of the specific entity. So from the AG side, we will not make specific recommendations on what action needs to be taken. We don't have a mandate, in fact, to do that.
I thought similar to what was done by the department, the investigation that was done by the NPA was done by an independent bank, not the OJC. In this case, I don't think such a firm would be found by the same. So that's why I was asking if they know what exit was
found.
Normally, the investigator does make some recommendations. So I think it would it would be good to get that information from the accounting officers themselves. They do know.
Okay.
Then,
lastly, before I step off the Department of Justice and the NPA, we have some recommendations that will, if followed, might resolve a clean audit outcome for both. Some of them you can clearly link to the qualifications, some of more in broad terms in terms of health and non-compliance that we have identified. And I think very useful as part of your oversight responsibility to also request management to give feedback on some of our recommendations and also, as Lawrence previously indicated, the commitment that they have made, their audit action plan, to really see all the department progressing in terms of their audit outcomes. So what we had recommended to them is that the accounting framework and the governance structure regarding third-party funds, if that will be finalized, they really drive the process because that will in the end ensure complete reliable reporting, and also that the current financial system and the internal control also need to be enhanced to ensure that that qualification that the Department of Justice currently has will be resolved. Then the next item more deals with the irregular expenditure, that the department did strengthen their controls to prevent, detect, and adequately disclose the irregular expenditure. And that for each and every major type of transaction and performance information, there need to be guidance, detailed policy procedures, business processes to in the end ensure complete reliable reporting. That all these policy procedures need to be communicated to all staff, need to be monitored, and the action taken against those officials that transgress against those policies and procedures. The next item deals then with the performance information, that the strategic plan needs to be reviewed to ensure that all your targets are smart. Smart statement, it's actually a statement that we make, it needs to be specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound. So that's how we measure the target. And then also that the indicators are clear, clearly written, that everyone understands what's expected from them to ensure consistent reporting in the end. Then we also recommend that they have a review process to ensure compliance with law and regulations. Decisive and immediate action need to be taken against people that do not comply with all laws and regulations. Very important, as part of the risk assessment, compliance needs to be identified as a matter that will be followed up. Secondly, in terms of your audit action plan, that they need to have audit action plans with realistic targets, deadlines, and then very important that there need to be individuals identified that will actually champion these implementation, and in the end that they will be held accountable if they've not achieved a clear outcome in terms of the implementation. And then very important that the action plans need to be monitored consistently and immediate action taken when not met. I actually want to add here that internal audits need to be involved as well, that they go and test the implementation of these action plans before we actually come and audit, because it's very easy to have action plans. People make good promises, but if you go actually to the testing of it, you might see still gaps. There might be some implementation, but not to the extent that will really satisfy the auditors. But I want to actually add here that internal audits need to be closely monitoring the implementation of these action plans. They're very important, as we previously indicated, we do quarterly assessments of the controls, and then we give feedback in terms of the dashboard report that management should take what we highlight to them in advance seriously to prevent a finding in the audit report. Very important that before the financial statements are submitted that there is a proper review process to ensure that we don't identify the errors, management identify the errors themselves. And then for, especially for the Department of Justice, all senior managers enter into performance contracts, and then obviously very important that actions are taken against poor performers. And that brings me to the end of our recommendations. Any questions or comments on the recommendations?
No.
Oh,
sorry.
Just a comment.
Yeah.
I recommendation recommendation looks to me not sensible, and yet excitement continues with something. Why is that it should not be sent coming up with the country framework and the government structure doesn't make my performance. For instance, this said by the bank, I think it is one of the ones that we need to better than consistently have in mind because I think there have been some recommendations given to the department to correct the matter and what people have been making it difficult for the department to do the things that are recommended. Because I'm sure if a year we come up across some of these things and then make a commendation and still nothing to do with it.
Jefferson, I have a bit of a difficult question. Because like the member rightfully said, we do make these recommendations, we also make them in our communications to management. So I would think that maybe that's a question to pose to management for them to maybe give the feedback.
Presentation just an overview of the audit outcomes of the other entities within the portfolio of justice. For all of them, except for the third party funds, they were financially unqualified. I'm going to quickly list as the FIU, Legal Aid of Africa, the Guardian Fund, then CARA, the Criminal Act Recovery Account, third party fund, as I said, you know, no financial statement has been submitted. And then for the president's funds, also financially unqualified. However, they are unqualified, it's not clear in all aspects because there was instances where there was finding on critical objectives or finding on non-compliance or still concerns in terms of your internal control environment. So it's very important not just to look at the audit opinion and then in the end gave a tick to say, you know, they are fine. There are some of them that are 100% clean in all the aspects, but not all of them. So for the SIU, there were some findings that we have on the predetermined objectives in terms of the presentation of the information as well as the usefulness. And then also findings of compliance financial statements. That finding normally deals with we have audited and we have found some errors which subsequently were corrected by management. Also in terms of expenditure management and then also in terms of your procurement environment. And then we link those concerns that we have in terms of either leadership and then performance information. Financial and performance management. For Legal Aid of Africa, it was clean in all aspects. The Guardian Fund were also clean in all aspects. Remember, in terms of the Guardian Fund, all their indicators are part of the Department of Justice, so that has been audited as part of that process. Then for CARA, they were clean, except we had a finding on the annual financial statements, which means that we've identified errors, which was subsequently corrected. So they were not clean from the start. We identified some concerns and in the end they received an unqualified opinion. And then for the president funds, they were also clean in terms of all the areas that we report on. Any specific questions in terms of the other entities in the justice portfolio?
I think you refer to those once we're done with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe just to give answer the human rights trust team as well. And the reason why we have not included them is because they are constitutional entities.
Yeah.
But I just want to follow the oversight.
The oversight is still here. We tend to forget that.
All right, I think what we need to just make a note of is that in next year's audit report, can you include the South African Human Rights Commission, even if it's on a separate as well as the Office of the Public Regulator?
In fact, Jefferson, what we will do is we will just amend the last slide and we will make it available through our office to your secretaries again. So you will have it by tomorrow, you will have those two outcomes summarized as well. I can cannot ever report to you that the opinions are unqualified, and then and I don't want to bind myself now, but there might have been some similar findings with regard to performance information here and there, you know. So it's not that serious, but we will definitely do everything to monitor it. Our quality.
That's it. Then it's my present duty to say thank you to both Peter and Wuta. Your presence here is greatly appreciated. Let me reiterate that next year we'll do it the other way around. And we will ensure that when we engage with either the department or any of the other entities, that you are present.
Anyone again?
All right, okay.
Mayor, Mr. Lowe, welcome once more. And we're looking forward to your presentation. We're in your hands. Please pull the mic and closer to you so that there's one provisional suspension from office. And then we have five reports which have to be confirmed what they considered in the respect of the withholding of remuneration of the defined method. And then there are two removals from office. I don't have an agenda. Do you want Mr. Stark to check this in
the beginning?
Thank you. Then I'll check the logic.
Just direct us which case we're dealing with so that we can find it in our document that we have before us. Honorable members, I take it all of you have these. We have the one from the research unit, which is the one I'm referring to. But Mr. Mayor and Mr. Lowe, you will indicate to us specifically which magistrate or which case you're dealing with so that we can find it, all right?
Thank you, Chair. And I'll ask Mr. Lowe to proceed with the holding matter.
Holding matter. This is the chair. This is Mr. Ole.
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 H-O-L-E.
So
now it's Ole. Well, it's not being, we're not on camera, so I suppose we're safe.
Mr. Hawley is a regional magistrate of Kimberley, and he's just a bit of background. He was an acting judge in the former Transkei from October 2004 to 2006. He was appointed a magistrate in December 2006 and in March 2007 appointed as a regional magistrate. This is in connection with his provisional suspension. On 17 May 2011, the regional court president of the Northern Cape in Kandala, after having received a complaint from a social worker about progress on certain matters, cases, forwarded copies of these inquiries to Mr. Hawley and other regional court magistrates in his region. Mr. Hawley took objection to the disclosure of these inquiries to him. And Mr. Hawley then caused a matter which was, that's on 7 June 2011, he caused a matter which was no longer on his role to be placed before him in a manner which might be considered as an abuse of power. He made an order to have the regional court president to be subpoenaed and in a case where he could not provide any evidence in respect of the charge on which the accused were appearing. The complaints follow from the transcript of the court proceedings. There's specifically two cases referred to here. That's the one is State versus Luetu, in which Mr. Hawley presided on 7 July 2011, when Mr. Kandala was summoned to appear before him. Mr. Kandala is his regional court president. A transcript of the court proceedings in the other case, Mbalula, in which Mr. Hawley presided on 7 June in the absence of the accused. The transcript indicates that Magistrate Smith remanded the case on 6 June to 20 June. There is no indication on the transcript record as to why the case was enrolled on his court trial on the 7th of June. The transcript of the court proceedings further indicate that Mr. Hawley presided in the matter on 7 July, that's a month later, while Magistrate Smith remanded the case on 20 June to 11 July. There's again no indication on the transcript record as to why the case was enrolled
on his court on the 7th of July. The transcript of the court proceedings further more indicates that Mr. Wally presided in a matter on 12 July while the case was remanded on 11 July to 14 and 15 December by Mr. Smith. There is also no indication on the Crown Court record as to why the case was held on his court on 12 July 2011. Now, the transcript of the Loetu case and the Balula case contained various remarks, utterances, and discussions by Mr. Wally, which I will elaborate in just now. In the Commission's view, inter alia displayed an abuse of judicial power as well as discussions, remarks, and comments on matters pertaining to the magistrate's profession in a manner which brought the judiciary into disrepute and which is detrimental to the image of the Office of Magistrate. This includes in causing the Regional Court President, Mr. Nkandala, to be ridiculed in public by using the court as a platform to do so. In the case State versus Loetu, in which Mr. Nkandala was subpoenaed to appear in the criminal proceedings on 7 July, the following extract from the top record of the proceedings give an indication of Mr. Wally's conduct. Now, when Mr. Nkandala objected because he felt that the prosecutor had no basis to think of any information about the rape case before the court proceedings, the following transpired. Court, that is now Mr. Wally. Please don't try and lead us astray. Your objections have no substance whatsoever. I shall not waste the court's time by hearing that any further. Then Mr. Nkandala. So I should not even raise the second objection, Your Worship. Court, I'm not interested. By taking up a matter with his head of office in court by asking Mr. Nkandala to read from the disputed letter and stating to Mr. Nkandala the following, court. You will recall, Mr. Nkandala, that I objected to you writing to me among other persons in this fashion and by questioning his head of office's qualification and on whether he knew the meaning of the accused's right to a fair trial, the following transpired, court. Mr. Nkandala, what qualifications do you hold? And your knowledge of fair trial rights of accused includes or does not include exclude the possibility of the regional court president writing to a junior magistrate under him and saying things like these about people I've tried. And also, do you know anything about the residual rights of an accused person to a fair trial? And by stating to Mr. Gandala about the letter regarding the fast tracking of the juvenile accused, court, do you think your inclusion of a letter which discloses information that paints the accused in a bad light amounts to an abomination? Mr. Gandala, a what? Court, an abomination. Mr. Gandala, abomination of what? And then the court, do you need an interpreter? And by saying the following to Mr. Gandala, court, we come back to square one. Why did you do it? Mr. Nkandala, I told you I did not disclose that information to you, and then there was the interjection. Court, you will not, I'm sorry, you will not say to me, you understand? What should I say? You don't know what to say? Maybe. And you call yourself a regional court president? Court, Nkandala, Your Worship, and then interjection, please. I don't think it will help. So that's right now, Mr. Nkandala. In court, please, Mr. Nkandala, you will show absolute respect for this court. You understand, sir? Don't come here with an attitude. Do you understand, sir? You will address me properly as a judicial officer sitting in this case. And please, wipe that smile off your face. Mr. Chair, I can go on with this. I don't know if you want me to just continue just to...
Oh,
all right.
They're enjoying it.
Okay. At a later stage, posing the following questions to Mr. Nkandala, court. Don't you think, Mr. Nkandala, you are a disgrace to the profession? And you see, Mr. Nkandala, you will agree that over the past year, there have been complaints against you about abuse of office, some of which emanated from myself. Isn't that correct? The court further questioned Mr. Nkandala about his right to allocate or reallocate cases to magistrates, and thereafter sent the following to Mr. Nkandala. Very well. What I will do, Mr. Nkandala, I will stand down. I will allow you to go to your junior officers and find out how it came about that the trial that I'm seized with suddenly found its way before another magistrate. The proceedings were then apparently held, the proceedings were in open court while, according to the charge sheet, two of the accused under the age of 18 years and the proceedings were under the age of 18 years and the proceedings should have been held in camera and in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. The regional court, the Baluluk matter, this is an indication of what I mentioned earlier, that there is no indication that the matter was postponed to those dates where in which Mr. Borley had the matter brought before him. That is just that bottom from that part.
Yeah.
And just on page 7 there, just at the top there, Mr. On 7 July 2011, Mr. Horry noted the following on the record. It's just one of the examples. M records, matter not in K court anymore. On 28/5/2011, was moved to M court without the knowledge of the presiding officer. The commission, in the circumstances, resolved that there was persons appointed to investigate these matters, and the commission resolved, in view of these incoming complaints, to extend the mandate of two regional court magistrates, Lowe and Beloy, who have been designated by the committee to conduct this investigation. Mr. Horley was afforded the opportunity to comment on the desirability of such provisional suspension. He responded in writing, and the commission considered his response and resolved to recommend that Mr. Horley be provisionally suspended. I have. His response here, Mr. Chair, I can also read here and there from that if you wish.
Okay.
I'm just trying to take a few aspects. During April 2010, I refer what I consider to be unlawful interference by the regional board president, Mr. Kandali, in my independence as a judicial officer. An instant example is a letter written by Mr. Kandala and directed me to, among others, where certain prejudicial information was disclosed to me without accused people appearing before me. To redeem the integrity of the court process, I caused Mr. Kandala to appear and question him about his conduct. My calling Mr. Kandala to account and what I said at the time is the basis that he sought to suspend me. And then further on, an indication was made first out to the letter, which all these matters were indicated, that I objected to the presiding disclosing inquiries to me. The allegations is made that I caused a matter which was no longer before me to be placed on my roll. The commission chose not to state which matter is being referred to in this paragraph, but whatever the case is, this statement is not true. The truth is that both Loetu and Baluluk matters were before me at all relevant times. It appears that it indicates that there was a duplicate charge sheet. The matter is being investigated to look into all aspects thereof. In Baluluk, he said, after receipt of the letter from the president, that's the regional court president, I instructed the clerk of the court to place both matters on the roll for 7 June. They were meant to have appeared in my court on 7 July and 11 July. The purpose of bringing them forward was to facilitate the making of an order for the president to appear. It did not occur proper to me to simply tell the clerk to issue the subpoena. I duly constituted the court and made the necessary orders. There is nothing sinister or unlawful about that conduct. It is not a trifle thing to subpoena the president, and when it is done, I surely must guarantee the clerk that this is by authority of court. And then, in any event, the matter was in my court at all material times. what I later established was done was for a duplicate, inverted commas, charge sheet to be drawn and the accused requisitioned without me knowing about it. The commission's intention, commission's attention is drawn to the evidence of Mr. Gandala on this aspect, where he disavows any knowledge of how the case that was before me and ended appearing before another matter between I had not accused myself. By saying, given the years of particulars, all I can say is that what I said was said by a judicial officer sitting on the bench in the execution of his sworn duty. It was bona fide and was necessary for the orders and rulings I made to be understood and placed in context. It would be unlawful of the commission to seek to suspend me for doing so. Besides, the allegations against me are built on a manipulation of the truth in an instance where the president has seriously misled the commission. Mr. Chair, I just need to also mention the matter is being investigated urgently, and the investigating team is reporting to the commission on a weekly basis on the developments. This all started also with, I don't know if you remember, I just mentioned also the Nosewick report where that was mentioned about Mr. Kandala at some stage, and now it's
obviously, this is very serious. You've got a regional court magistrate and a regional court president. These are not, even at district level, this would be unacceptable. But at a regional court level, where magistrates can sentence people to life imprisonment, these allegations are very serious. What I would like to know is the investigation. Has Mr. Hardy laid any complaints against the regional court president?
He has laid a lot of complaints,
and are they also
belayed? They were investigated. A report has been compiled that the commission has decided to hold that in advance, pending the finalization of the investigation against the order, so that both matters can be considered before them.
So, it would have been useful to see his letter as well, but it wasn't attached out. He's referring, our documents refer to annexes, even that is one of them. And hopefully in the future we can get the response that should be part of our documents. Is there a reason why it's not attached?
They are going through the allegations there and going through. You mean the letter, his response letter?
Yes. Correct. You referred to it in the briefing to Parliament.
And we're not aware of that.
We don't have that.
But we can easily make a copy for you.
That's the basis. That is, I don't want to state my feelings about you wanting to. That just is, to me, a very serious matter, and my prima facie view, subject to what other members might say, is that we need to. This is a provisional suspension pending an investigation. Just on the light of these allegations, that seems unacceptable to total rebellion against authority to subpoena your regional court president to appear before you in a court with it. And there are a number of cases, but particularly the one relating to the youth. I don't understand what the reasoning was. The youth here, the court should have been in camera. There seem to be very serious allegations here. I'm trying to understand what was the purpose of subpoenaing the regional court president to appear. What evidence could the regional court president give to pursue that criminal prosecution against the youth? Are you able to? Otherwise, I'm in full agreement with the provisional suspension. I don't understand what the purpose is.
Sorry, it appears that he has issues with Mr. Kandala, and that's got nothing to do with a specific case. And he is using that opportunity to get him. And he also mentions also his personal also complaints that he has against Mr. Gandala. He also mentions that in his response, which I read out.
I'm not a legal person. I do have the basic knowledge of any South African that a judge or a magistrate needs to be neutral in dealing with issues. I don't think that this man that is mentioned here is now having any capacity of being neutral. He seems to be very personal. He seems to be very arrogant, I would say. And I think maybe it's good for him to be given a short rest to cool his temper.
Yeah,
we
can all.
I don't know if we can to see, but I happen to know Mr. Awale.
I
actually did serve as the group of like this together. So why do I say my group the universal that? But my reading of this document is that it doesn't give us a full picture of what happened. The snippet of what transpired in the court are given. And as someone indicated, we don't have the full picture of why this kind of court behavior occurred. It doesn't make sense to me to say that the regional court matches is the one who is superior to come forth. I would have thought if he needed some information from his colleagues, he would have done it with him. I don't even understand how he agreed to come to court.
If you can summon Christian from
there, then. Now, still, it has been disclosed that Mr. Ole has issues with the provisional consent to the extent of something late, okay? Late of this to the commission. So, he's a good data to me, at least. Of course, on the face of it, it's but I don't quite know what Madala and Oumu point is for us.
We're going to have an issue for the inquiry to they were after all part of the full inquiry.
Yeah, it looks like there has to be a full inquiry to get the full picture. Now, I do not know whether, therefore, that kind of inquiry necessitates the need for the provisional suspension of Mr. Owen. Of course, the commission has said that needs are over time, but last year, we don't have that kind of inquiry. I have no doubt as to why it is correct because of the lack of responsibility. But I myself am shocked.
Information they have to be dropping off at charge. Mm. the theory study is before provisional suspension needs to go through, then the inquiry has to proceed within 2 months. So, can I be drafted?
I would support the provisional suspension in view of the fact that these allegations are such a certain nature that it's difficult to consider a regional court magistrate and continue performing the function. If we then institute the provision, he still gets his salary, as you said, the inquiry is an expedite and quickly. You've indicated that the inquiry will also include the inquiry against the regional court magistrate. The president as well. So, but it just to me, on the basis of what we've got here, which is transcripts from the record of these cases, the allegations are strong enough to support that we have posted. And he, as you said, as Smith said, we were given an opportunity to respond. And I don't think that response is sufficient to satisfy our concerns about the abusive process. Yes, we will have the inquiry which will give more information, but from his perspective, I don't think that he's given sufficient reason in that letter not to provision. That's why I would support the provision.
While supporting the provisional suspension, I put a bit of a worry as to who is trying to create a situation where this guy is working, going back, but taking each other physical, because there is still a person, and then eventually a technical. It's a complicated
matter. So when he's provisionally suspended, you're saying he's still allowed to come to the magistrate's court?
My worry, Chair, is talking from experience, or not, as Chairperson of ACS University, I think of this lady quite seriously behind in the process, a technical. I'm one of them, a technical.
Is he suspended?
Yes.
Oh. So then no one gets suspended then? Well, that's the implication of what you're saying. No one will be suspended out of fear that they will come to blows. All right. Jim wants to respond.
Chairperson, Mr. Wally is not at the office at the moment. The minister has already provision suspended in front of office, but he's not at the office at the moment. It's just for Parliament now to confirm the provision suspension.
Nani informs me that we need to be formally. I thought this was a formal statement. My committee secretary says no, actually it's not. So I'm a bit. Well, we don't have a quorum, one.
Yeah.
And two, it needs. Is it correct that you must still formally refer to us?
Correct.
And this is not the formal referral to us?
No, Chairman has found that. Heard from Bernard, it has been tabled in Parliament, these reports.
I think so.
Yeah. But a phone thing also, I'm assuming, is next door.
Yeah.
On the pen side.
Yeah.
So we could go
Well, let me just check with Mr. Romano about this formal taken. I'm told it has been formally taken.
The report has been tabled, but not yet referred to the committee. Well, it's the first time I've said in the third principle of the... the energy market.
So what is this that we have here? Is a report from the commission.
Yeah.
And it needs the NA table to formally refer the matter.
Formally refer to the committee for consideration and report, yeah.
So there's nothing preventing us from listening to our quality control measures.
No.
And then in their absence.
So that when we receive the formal tabling from the table,
yes.
then we are informed and we can proceed.
I can't bear the waste of your time.
No, it's not a waste of time.
In that case, then, if indeed we were required to take it, I don't mean the entire fine, but something that is going to give us at least something of a positive. Like, for instance, I can say, we do not know the data, it is quite a continuous tumult. And also, the extract, somewhat one sided. We don't know what transpired outside of these snippets that we have in the report. We don't know what transpired in Kandala to obey things and also what the airport said. And also the letter, the representation by the magistrate. We don't know what it is to explain this recorded order.
Chair, I have made a copy of the response. If a copy can be made from this, I can have this now available. The background, if you want to be informed that the allegations against Mr. Kandala, I have that here available if you want to. If I understand correctly what is meant by
I think what Mr. Honemeyer is asking for is what led to this happening. I mean, all we have now is that the president, Mr. Kandala, is appearing before Mr. Holland's court now. And you would correctly say he was summoned, was subpoenaed. But what motivates that? That's what we want. That's what Mr. Honemeyer has asked for. So he couldn't have just got up one morning and said, okay, we have a subpoena, I'm signing it, and putting President Kandala's name there and deliver it to him.
Mr. Chair, it appears that this does have a long way coming.
Yes.
There were, at some stage, there's a lot of news reports against Mr. Kandala in the notebook, and the view was held that these came from Mr. Holland. That was the, although that's not, I don't think it can be true, but the information was quite serious, the allegations against Mr. Kandala. And then Mr. Kandala had a lot of complaints that he submitted to the commission. And in Asia also this matter, these matters that are indicated from the transcript. And that is why the commission wants to look at both the report, the allegations against Mr. Kandala, and the allegations by Mr. Kandala against Mr. Hore to have simultaneously addressed this matter.
Are you able then to provide us with some kind of a background document of matters as they led up to this? Because clearly there were things that happened, and you referred to Newsweek and so on. All that can be provided in a background document. Because, you don't just summon your president to appear in your court. Well, and so all that information in a document for members to look at, and then, as he said, to get a bigger picture, clearer picture.
with the chair. You know, I have a summary here which I have made ready for for the ethics committee, which was used that summarized now the allegations against Ndala. I don't know if that, of course, that is what the investigation is going on about, to give all the details about what led to each and to get supporting evidence to that effect.
Honourable Member, that summary and Mr. Holland's written response, will that?
That's not enough. We need, so surely you then get a similar summary against Mr. Holland today. I don't, because then we only get the case against Mr. Nkadala, which isn't quite fit, we need that background. We need the information against Mr. Holland, but together with that.
Yes.
If we only had that, then we don't have the whole story against Mr. Holder. That's what, that's the essence of what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
A copy of the report sets out everything as all the background details. There's a certain part of the report, the report which the minister is going to submit. Contains all the information as I had it also from Mr. Nkandala and even more. I don't know if that would help, but that is the report.
That's not the report we have here.
That's correct.
So that we're all getting a good information, but that's the same information that was for the ethics for the whole MA.
Is what we have before us, Mr. Lowe, is what the minister considered.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
This is NHSC.
The difficulty that we're going to be faced with is we're going to be trying to deal with two cases at once. Now, I appreciate we need to understand the background, but the Kadala case is not before us. We need that background, but we shouldn't be influenced by that case which is not before us.
We're not going to take a decision today.
Now, I'm just understanding the difficulty that you'll be faced with, because we'll sit with that for the ethics committee. So look at this, our defense, he should be suspended, but that would be it for some other thing. Mm. But let's take the documentation one step at a time.
All right. I'm appeased by the fact that we don't have to take a decision now.
Yes,
all right. So we're still on solid ground. I acknowledge that we are still lacking in certain information. Mr. Lowe, and if you are able to provide us with that, we'd be most grateful.
A copy can be made now, so that the response I have made, that could be made available to you.
Right. Let's do that.
Well, it can be done systematically. But this is a difficult of mine.
Yes.
I don't know how to react with it. But it's very difficult.
So we're grateful to you for declaring your, and I don't think you must. But nothing to be afraid of. You've declared that you don't ask for anything, and I think that's only appropriate. When we are sitting to take a decision, that is when you will have to consider whether you should recuse or not. But for now, I think it's okay if you could only sit here and participate. I don't see a problem. So that's Magistrate Holly. Next one, Mr. Lowe.
The next one will be Mr. Matinda from Ndazi.
Yeah,
no
more.
No,
I don't know.
This is for the withholding of remuneration. He was charged
He's charged with misconduct, just background. The misconduct is he acted in contravention of the Domestic Violence Act. He failed to comply with a court order. Another charge, assault of Princess Masinga with an axe, and the assault of Immaculate Masinga with a broom and kicking her. He was provisionally suspended on 3 February 2010 with remuneration, and he was also criminally charged with attempted murder. Now, he was convicted in the Regional Court Durban of the attempted murder on 23 May 2011. The Matters Commission resolved that his remuneration be withheld on 26 September 2011. He is now on provisional suspension and to speak without remuneration at this stage. And he intends taking the criminal conviction on appeal after sentence. His sentence has not been delivered, although it has been set down at the result of the postponement. I think his sentence will be in December sometime. The misconduct inquiry commenced on 26 August 2010. It has been postponed on a number of occasions. Evidence needs to be led on the 31st of October, end of this month, and the 1st of November. I have a long list here. I can indicate why the matter was postponed every time with the reasons thereof and why it took so long if we are only here where we are now with a misconduct inquiry, he has been on suspension with salary for quite some time. His background was given at some place with the accommodation with it. But, what's the quote from him? Well, he was provisionally suspended
with salary.
With salary. On 3 February 2010,
with salary,
and without salary now from the 26th of September, last month. Yes.
On the recommendation of the commission,
his salary has already now been taken away, and he's now without salary.
May I just the commission determines, in terms of the act, the commission determines to withhold remuneration, and the minister has to accompany and find it important as regard in parliament, and then parliament needs to confirm the determination.
What do you want to
see?
It was during 2009.
The murder?
All three matters, it was in 18 March 2009, the attempted murder.
Right.
He is intending to do that after the sentence. The next one is against Mr. Marua of Davidson Benoni. I could just say that he has resigned with effect from 17 October 2011.
Did he know you were coming here?
We took his salary and although he has now resigned, for Parliament to confirm the determination of the National Commission to withhold his remuneration, this determination was taken for the resignation.
Okay.
council members, do you want to go through the details of the matter?
I don't think we need, as I understand it, we need the appeal of the
well, all that's left for us is to endorse the decision to withhold its salary. Okay, all right. Thank you, Mr. Lowe. Next one.
Mr. Chair, I thought just for information purposes, there was a Mr. Skrenya that has also been suspended since 4th of November. He's not on that, but he also resigned. It's one of the matters that has been being that came up. I don't make that mention without you mentioning it now.
No, please don't, because okay. It's a problem for me. It's in the media then. I'm looking for me and saying, what about this matter that we heard about? And then I've got to go digging amongst my doctor.
I apologize.
Chair,
no.
Then
the next matter is Mr. Meraki.
Yes.
He's from Lichtenberg. He's also been convicted of 2 charges of theft. He's not been sentenced yet. And he also indicated that he's going to take the decision of the court to find him guilty on appeal. The chairperson, the commission is of the view that the withholding of, there's no reason not to withhold his remuneration at this stage. We are proceeding with the misconduct inquiry on the 21st of September, November, sorry.
He was invited to show cause. Have you done that?
He did, chairperson. He said he's got a lot of family responsibilities, elderly.
Oh, so it's
elderly.
It's litigating.
Yeah.
It's not anything to do with the procedure and
not
the question.
Except that he's appealing, because he intends to appeal the decision of the regional court of appeal.
What about my bills?
Thank you, Chairperson. I see even our former Chief Justice, the Honourable Judge, Mr. Justice Jacobson in the Constitutional Court, held that there would be no reason for a magistrate to give even a provisional suspension. In the circumstances of each case, of course, taking that into account, to withhold the remuneration, supported by the Constitutional Court.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Next matter.
Thank you, Chairperson. Then, with regard to Mr. Jacobson and Mr. Kamani, I'd like to look at Mr. Jacobson. There are 2 reports, Chairperson.
Mr. Jacobson.
Now, Jacobson took a lump.
There is 2 Jacobs.
It's one Jacobs, but there are 2 reports. The one report pertains to the removal from office. And the other one is the withholding of the narration pending his removal from office.
I've got 2.
The head of office, the district court magistrate for that district. There's only one magistrate per district. Some offices have additional magistrates, like Victoria, you've got 60 or 70 additional magistrates, but there's only one magistrate that's the judicial head.
So that's below the chief magistrate.
The
in lay terms, they call them chief magistrate, the chief of office, the chief magistrate, but he's not in rank a chief magistrate, he's just not in rank. He's the only magistrate in Chocolat.
Sure.
All
right.
Which one are you dealing with first?
Jacobs,
yes.
And then the removal from office.
Okay.
And the chairperson, he was charged with misconduct initially in terms of regulation 26 of the regulation for judicial officers in lower court. The 12 counts of misconduct emanating from him being drunk on duty and being absent from the office. He was arrive at the office in the morning and then leave and come back later, or would not come back at all, and then being in a state of not dealing with matters. We had, I think Mr. Jeffries had a problem in the fact that it was this not a cause of alcohol dependency, which could be construed as continued ill health. But at the misconduct inquiry, the defense then raised the point and said they will ask the minister for Mr. Jacobs to vacate office if he could continue his health based on the fact that he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder emanating from an incident 30 years ago when he was doing national duty as a soldier. We had this clinical psychologist to testify, but he said that he still, Mr. Jacobs' willpower, his decision to take alcohol. And we are therefore, we were of the view, and we argued that in the inquiry, that it would not be fair for Mr. Jacobs to be vacating office on continued ill health and gaining another 5 years of pensionable salary. It actually boiled down to an incapacity investigation. So we terminated the misconduct inquiry and we proceeded with an incapacity investigation in terms of Regulation 57, and the presiding officer recommended it was executive, even his legal representative. Admitted that he has not had, that he doesn't have the capacity to carry out his duties of office efficiently. So that was the resolution taken by the presiding officer. That was the findings made and it was endorsed by the commission. And the commission then recommended to the minister that he be removed from office in terms of section 13(4)(a)(2) of the capacity. In the meantime, we also withhold his remuneration.
But then, quite funny, you seem to be inquiring into the past in the 5 years worth of the reception that he's. The decision that he's incapable of holding office has not been decided in order.
That's correct.
Your one page where he's given an opportunity to respond further on 3.5, and he failed to respond, or one presumes his legal representative also failed to give further reasons. What is that 3.5 that he's asked? Is that one step up? I don't quite understand that question.
Our chairperson, after having made the finding of the presiding officer, is made known to the particular magistrate, and then he has 10 days to submit any representation if he failed to do. So the commission dealt with the matter about it.
I mean, what are usually the consequences of a final incapacity? We don't have everything under the new dispensation and the principle of that. But what I usually respond to is that how people then recruit whatever pension fund they themselves have built up for and actually sitting behind our board clearly is in capacity. How are people with financial?
Yeah, it's like a resignation. There's not going on pension. Not like retirement. This is what the clinical psychologist testified about. Dr. Chaplin said later, dated the 5th of November 2010, with regards to Mr. Jacobs' legal representative. He says here, he developed a serious alcohol dependency over the last 5 years, which had a detrimental effect on his ability to perform his duties as a magistrate. By this, he acquired a series of charges against him as a magistrate commission at his deciding to advise the minister about his future ability to perform his duties on the bench. By realizing the seriousness of his dependency, he created tremendous tension and anxiety over a period of time. In realizing that his career as a deputy and the implications of that on the household, children thought that the tension accumulated. But in realizing the implications of his deteriorating ability in the legal system, violating not only his external ability to perform justice, but also violating his own personal ethics, he admitted himself to Corona Psychiatric Clinic on the 9th of June 2010. Corona Psychiatric Clinic runs an extensive and intensive therapeutic program over the last, over at least 2 week period. This program has a four-fold foundation, in essence,
The program is built on intensive individual therapy where a chemical psychologist is allocated to the patient. Okay, then, and on initial appearance, Mr. Jacobs is psychiatrically treated for a major depressive disorder. Secondly, he was treated for physical withdrawal symptoms. It was only during this individual psychological therapy admission assessment that the primary cause of his condition was detected, and that is at the age of 17, Mr. Jacobs had to perform a compulsory 2-year military training and was sent to the Kapiti border to fulfill his duties. At this young age, because of his leadership quality, he was appointed as platoon commander. Italy, as a young boy, he had to make decisions about life and death to protect his country from the enemy. Even at this young age, he doubted the rationality of the war, but he had no choice and he was forced into a position to make decisions that he was emotionally not equipped for. His period at war epitomizes the classical version of the South African post-traumatic stress disorder. The traditional diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder was coined during and after the American Vietnam War of the 60s. Young boys sent flight to fight a foreign war in a foreign country, but the American boys came back to home, in inverted commas, safe country, and they were received as heroes. By this heroic return, was then the essence of the healing quality for the symptoms they had experienced that was quite post-traumatic stress disorder. And then that manifested himself in alcohol dependency. And now he suffered from brain atrophy. So his brain is shrinking. So he cannot perform his functions on the bench. But we specifically asked at the inquiry, what is the cause? And that's where the clinical psychologist testified that he needs to have the expert evidence of a neurologist and a psychoneurologist, which he didn't call.
Who didn't call?
Mr. Jacobs.
Okay.
So we were of the view that it would not be fair for him to make this statement. And Mr. Dr. Heather Lonnet even went so far and said that it is for Mr. Jacobs, although he's suffering from this, it is for him to decide whether or not to go to the liquor store and buy himself a drink, even before going to court. So the decision is, ultimate decision is his. And it's not, he could not testify as to whether it was the cause of the post-traumatic stress disorder. Jefferson, I'm quite frank, we've all done military training. If we all depressed, I can start drinking now and add a 5 years of pensionable salary, and now I'm asking for the minister to have me released from office.
Unfortunately, I'm in PG contract. All right, we're going to move back on the clippings. My apologies.
Okay, so where do we go from here?
If we could just refresh some. Not a massive amount of information, but just some confirmation that people have built up a pension fund in their own and they want to. We also have not been able to just see the confirmation that we have to buy himself another pension fund.
I'm happy to have that. And it seems that the recent military pension amendment bill, which was passed by Parliament, recognized that both statutory and non-statutory suffered. And he's allowing financial assistance for medical treatment, that there's a means test which I don't think you're qualified for now. But it recognizes both, as I said, very important, statutory and non-statutory. It is a national service, it's supporting the struggle, whatever it is, it's recognized. And it's important for us to be aware of that. But it's a very big tough one because, as you say, as an alcohol dependent, you take that decision every day. So why? I think it would be nice to know that he had some pension, and I'd be concerned if the state contribution is not tendered. We need specific advice on that, because he's given a lot of 28 years of service. It would be interesting to know that figure. But at the end of the day, it's just obvious to find that he's not capable of being treated.
When did
he
start?
1982.
I don't know. The alcohol is
Jefferson, 2 or 3 years ago, no, maybe 4 years, most of the complaints emanated from his colleagues. important that the chief magistrate would then request it to submit an affidavit in that regard to the commission. And based on that affidavit, we commenced our inquiry and investigation. And we found really that we had several discussions with him personally and with his wife. His children were even there at the inquiry.
I'm just curious because I'm curious to know what she did. Because you see, I mean, he died in 83 of magistrate, and just 4 years ago. What triggered it?
The additional effect of realizing that your little bit of alcohol is not impacting your work, and it gets worse than what it was, so then people start picking it up and find it snowball.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a layman's discussion. I mean, almost it does allow. Not in human nature to a degree, but I think I still when it's a layman, and I wouldn't want to make my mind up about. I remember the case very vividly, it is in my mind, no doubt, from the previous account, that the incapacity is the right finding. So the only question that then arises, what consequences should there be? And I think I heard you reading that he elected not to call a neuropsychiatrist or a neurologist. Now, those would have been the people who could have testified on that post traumatic stress. Is a lot of post-traumatic stress reportage now, all these years later, after the trade world, it did have an effect on people. For whatever reasons, it's all only surfacing now. But I don't say that we can deduce from that had any effect on this man. We don't know what triggered the alcoholism. I agree, absolutely incapacities that I find. If he didn't bring expert medical evidence to testify to that, both traumatic stress, then the boarding is not an option or other compensation. But then the only thing I would like to feel satisfied about is that we will get all the money that we do here so that we can invest in or buy another thing.
Thank you, Chairperson. We'll be here next week to the select committee. So I think we might be able to just submit that information to you next time next week. This is the next report is the withholding of remuneration. Also in support of the underlying case, there is no reason for a magistrate who is found to be unfit or incapacitated to receive his remuneration whilst Parliament is in the process of removing him from office. And it can still go a few months because we need to. You need to advise them both the NA and the NCFP. Then it has to go back to the minister. The minister to then remove him from office if the parliament so agrees. So we also request, well, the determination has already been made. It's just for parliament to confirm the withholding of this remuneration.
Suppose the concern of the committee is that because in a way he is not fully to blame for anything. And therefore we need to be sure that we are going to end up with the end of the limitation of the commission. Otherwise we can't keep him employed. And for the record, he joined the department in 1983, but was appointed as magistrate in June
1983. But the tension that where the 1983 date comes in. Okay.
Next letter. Thank you, Chair. The next is to Mani. Chairperson has also got two reports. The one is being held in now. It's part of the removal from office. Misconduct, which I'm guilty of three kinds of misconduct involving sexual harassment. The presiding officer requested that he was recommended that he be removed from office. The commission considered the representations and endorsed the recommendation and recommended to the minister that he be removed from office on the ground of misconduct. In terms of section 13.4 of the Act, the Commission recommends the removal from office. The Minister must file such a report or suspend that matter if it is not provisionally suspended. It is provisionally suspended. Confirm the suspension. Now, Chairperson, before the Minister could suspend him from office and file a report in Parliament, Mr. Dumani filed an urgent application in the High Court, instigating and restraining the Minister. To take any further steps in this regard, pending an application, another application in the High Court, that the presiding officer's finding of him being found guilty of misconduct is set aside, so reasonable set aside. Now, the urgent application was not opposed by the minister, so he was effectively restrained to take any further steps, and then we were advised that the the order was dismissed with cost on the 12th of August this year. So, having been informed of the application being dismissed, we again approached the minister and said that the commission's resolution still stands that he be removed from office. So, we approached the minister and requested him to table his support to Parliament and suspend him from office. Now, apparently, just after that, the Mr. Dumani took the review application, the dismissal, against the court, and he's intending to, he's in the process of asking leave for appeal against that decision to the Supreme Court. Now, in terms of Rule 49, which you're not aware of, that suspends the original order. So, the minister, and we've been just being advised now yesterday by counsel, because Mr. Dumani is threatening now to have the minister arrested for contempt of court. Would he proceed? Would he proceed to table this report in Parliament? I think the report has already been tabled, and we have to deal with. Maybe we could not request the minister or advise the minister to withdraw this report as from yesterday and from this morning. So we have the view that the committee maybe just keep it in abeyance until a date has been set for this application for leave to appeal. If it's been refused, then of course the suspension does not, and then we can remove him from office. But there's a step there.
This is
sort
of showing a new new tactic, and that is to bring an urgent ex parte application to court against the minister, where you get an interim order pending the institution of a review application. This was brought in the 24th of October. The interim order advice would be granted, and then the review would heard a year later, so you get a summons for a year.
Yeah.
So this is now a new tactic.
Yeah.
What we need to ensure here is the costs are recovered. The costs must be recovered, and it's not the magistrate, it's
not
the
minister.
And again, we're looking at the Justice Department going to get it on not recovering costs. And not recovering Now, I appreciate that there could be an appeal, but all indications are that it will probably be dismissed again. So we need to look at cases like this, because this could, the word could now get out for all these disciplinary actions, including an ex parte in his application. And you interdict the minister, and that's it. You might lose your review application. It takes 18 months. Now he's appealing against that.
So it goes on.
And
he gets
his salary.
The cost must be recovered.
Cost must be recovered. That's for the minister's office.
Yeah.
In fact, this is now in a way. We can do nothing about it. We should probably take note now that there's a electronic application to obtain leave to appeal. I wonder if he's done that. That was an atrocity. He would have had to do that already. But presumably he's got leave to appeal.
Jefferson, the papers have already been filed, but there's not a date set yet, and we requested counsel, acting for the minister, to instruct the attorneys to try and set the case as soon as possible, obtain a date from the register.
Is that the application for leave?
For leave to appeal. If that's not been granted, then the minister can proceed. Well, like I said, we have not been able to ask the minister about the minister to withdraw this report, so it's still before you. But it's been advised that we should not proceed. So I can just
go and
I just I will convey that to you.
Anything else? Yeah, we shouldn't be surprised, actually. Surprised taking this long.
Well, Chairperson, I'm going to say the Maruwa matter, they also wanted to take that to court, but unfortunately it was not.
Yes.
So we can await the others also finding the specific application.
Mm-hmm.
Chairperson, and the other report is the withholding of remuneration.
Yes. Are we able to proceed with that, or do we hold back on that as well?
Chairperson, we are of the view, and that is Council's view as well, that the Commission determines to withhold remuneration.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it's not for the minister to, it's not for the minister, and he's got no discretion in that regard. He has to table that report in terms of the Act in Parliament. The Commission determined to withhold his remuneration, so that's a separate application, that's a separate issue. The application is against the minister, not to take any further, not to the Commission, so the Commission is not involved. So we recommend that you confirm the Commission's determination to withhold his remuneration in the new one.
Who's busy, you know, we expect that to confirm. Is that of the Commission or that of the new?
So, person, in terms of the Act, the recommendation for removal from office, that needs to be the Parliament needs to pass a resolution whether or not to restore the particular mate, because if the actually the minister has already suspended him from office. Okay, that is now the issue which is to be dealt with in court.
Mm-hmm.
But the determination of the Commission is just needs condemnation from Parliament as well.
So we need to monitor that new change.
Yeah.
Any more, Mr. Mayor?
Thank you, Chief Justice.
All right. I think on formal, we will be formal.
But they will be formally tabled, yes. But at least when it's done, we will be giving up on an informed basis. Mr. Mayor, Mr. Lowe, thank you very much. I appreciate your presence and your input. Is there anything else, honourable member? No? Then we're adjourned. Thank you.